Staging Sound, a podcast reflecting on theatre music, sound design, sonic practices and experiences. Welcome to this episode of Staging Sound. This is the second part of the audio papers special, if you want to call it that, which was a particular panel in the conference we held in Munich in September 23. This combined a number of audio papers that were then discussed in a subsequent panel discussion, which you will hear in a couple of episodes. Right now, you will hear three audio papers submitted for this particular section, and they are by the British sound designers Paul Clark and Melanie Wilson, and a third one, which was submitted by the Australian director and artist researcher and composer-dramaturg Alison Campbell and Meta Cohen. Three very exciting papers and interesting and stimulating pieces of thought. Enjoy this episode.
Hello. I want to share one contextual thought about the issues that you bring up in this forum, and to just give you four on the ground examples of things that I've experienced which might bring out those points. So firstly, the context. I've said elsewhere in interviews and things that I've considered myself fortunate in the past to have been in a situation with theatre and performance more generally that no one really has a proper definition of what a proper theatre score is in the way that there is for film scores. Someone could say, that sounds like a film score, and would kind of expect you to know what they mean. But I don't know if I've ever heard anyone say, that sounds like a theatre score. Because theatre scores are so uncodified and so in transition because of all the issues that I think you're well aware of, the grey area between sound design and music and the sheer onrush of technology which has made things be possible. But for me, it's not just a technical thing, it's an aesthetic thing. It's just that thought that no one in reviews or producers or collaborators seems to have a fixed idea of what they want from me. And I see that as being an incredibly fortunate position to be in. And so the four examples I'm going to give you just unlock that idea a little bit, as well as addressing some of the other topics about how sound designers and composers work. So the first example I want to give is of my work with Claude Ensemble, which straddles theatre, live art, dance, gig. It's kind of difficult to pin down, but we come from a sort of theatre background, I suppose, and our work has flourished in different ways. Now, in that example, I have always been the sound designer and the composer, partly because the concept of sound designer barely existed in 1994 when I started. And so just by default, I learned how to, you know, do basic speaker design. I already knew how to use microphones from work in recording studios and was using sort of elementary technology before we all had QLab and, you know, proper queuing systems. But whenever we needed sound design, I was the person that did it. And the beauty of that is, once again, I wasn't bound to any definition of what roles were, but also there was no one to stop me just trying something out. And so the example that I'm going to choose is a piece called Red Ladies, which we first did in the early 2000s, and that's had many incarnations. I could have chosen any of the dozens of performances that we've made over those 27 years or however long it is. Just picked this one mainly because of the sheer number of musical and sound choices that were made without regard to what their status was. And my principal collaborator was Susie Wilson, who's a director and choreographed the movement sequences and dealt with the visual component of the piece. We came up with the concept of the piece together. From a sound perspective, it had so many dimensions. The piece was based on musical structures rather than dramatic structures. It was a huge web, a massively ambitious sort of sound-led performance. So here's just a taste of some of the things that this piece involved. The script for that show was almost entirely made out of spoken word sound samples that I'd collected over many years. It was pre-YouTube, so, you know, from CDs, libraries, radio and TV, all edited, tuned, and cut up and woven into the soundscape and created a texture. So all the spoken word is essentially a piece of sound design, but we didn't call it that. The sort of extremes were some of the outdoor performances we had. I had to write a brass band piece, which was timed to coincide with a helicopter flight over Trafalgar Square so that the piece peaked exactly when the helicopter arrived and all the fountains in Trafalgar Square went off. I also wrote several songs, some setting old Irish proverbs, others setting the UN Declaration of Human Rights, all of this within the same project. You know, there's something which sounded almost like a Captain Beefheart song. There was some a hip-hop thing which someone compared to Jay Dilla. There was all sorts of musical textures. We used animal sounds, sometimes textured and interwoven with all the speaking samples that I'd collected. It was an unusually large range of, you know, somewhat sound designy, somewhat musical components. Ideas that no one would have asked me to do. And a producer wouldn't have thought, oh, we need someone who can do this. It was the fact that there were no defined roles that allowed it to happen. And all these disparate sound design and musical elements came together in a way which pleased me and worked very well for the aims of the piece. And I wonder now whether, had I have started that piece with a huge team and defined roles of sound designer, technician, composer, maybe researcher for text research and dramaturg and so on, whether that piece would have had the long life, the many performances in dozens of places over the years, that some of the life of that was in the fluidity of roles, even though most of those roles were actually held by one person. The process just emerged out of an engagement with the material over a number of months and actually years. So I'm thankful that we didn't lock down those definitions. My second, third, and fourth example are all sound designers that I've worked closely with over the years. They're all very well-known British sound designers. And I've had different relationships with all of them in terms of how we collaborate. With all of them, I've done at least a couple of shows with Katie Mitchell, which were, you know, end-on theatre shows with quite large-scale sort of sound design ambitions and commensurate sort of technology and support to make that happen. So the first example is Gareth Fry, who I've worked with for many years. And it was with him that we worked on the first of those live cinema productions that Katie Mitchell is known for. Sometimes there was live music. There was always an abundance of sound design content. And I'll use the rough definition of sound design as things that were not obviously pitched or obviously rhythmic to the untrained ear. And I use that definition because that's sort of the way that Gareth and I defined it for ourselves. When we would always have a discussion before each piece to work out what roles we would have. And that would be a fluid thing. It didn't change a huge amount, but we would just sort of check in. And the kind of discussion we would have would be things like, he'd say something like, well, I'm thinking that I really want to get bassy on this show or something like that. And I would think, okay, so maybe I'm not going to focus on the bass. It really could be as simple as that. But we always had a really simple rule. That doesn't mean that we didn't make suggestions to each other. We would feed back to each other and we would make offerings to each other. You know, a typical thing would be Gareth wants to put in a drone and I'd maybe suggest changing the pitch of it because it would be more useful for me if it was G sharp or something like that. But we had a very simple division of labor there, and I would never get involved in the sound of a dog barking or whatever. And he would never get involved in the creation, even though he could have done, get involved in the writing of a, you know, a song or something like that. But it wasn't a dry way of working at all, and loads of amazing things emerged out of this simple way of carving up things. You know, I would give Gareth technical problems to solve, and he'd offer me technical solutions, which made me think musically differently. One example was the Cat in the Hat, which for various reasons involved Gareth creating this way of working with Ableton Live and QLab together, which I know he uses a lot now, which gave me ways of working with a flexible sort of looping system of music, which didn't sound like it was looping, which I still use, he still uses. But it made me think of different ideas. That score would have sounded completely different if he hadn't have come up with this solution. The next example would be Melanie Wilson, who I worked with on several shows. She came to those productions employed as a sound designer. As our relationship grew, she was getting more confident with her own compositional skills and was well able to deal with some of the musical content of productions. And I was up for experimenting with the way that we worked. And so we did a few shows where that exchange process that I was talking about with Gareth became much more fluid. One example that springs to mind is Cleansed, which we did at the National Theatre in London, where we exchanged every kind of material. You know, I would send sort of abstract sounds, Melanie would send ideas for beats, and we would be transferring this material over several iterations back and forth between us. And we pretty much lost track of who'd created what in huge parts of the show. There were still areas where it was pretty clear, you know, that some of the big musical numbers of songs and so on, I took care of. But really, there were whole parts of it where if you played it to me now, I wouldn't be able to tell you whether, you know, who had made what. And we ended up, the last time we collaborated, I think we actually shared the credit of a composer and sound designer. That's sort of where it ended up. And the final example I wanted to give is with Donato Wharton, who fits somewhere in between those two. There's much more crossover than with Gareth, but perhaps not as much as with Melanie. And we'll always have a long, involved discussion beforehand about how those roles get divvied up. So, you know, one example I can remember is of doing a production of The Maids with Tonil Group. And Donato was really, really keen to work with sort of metallic sounds in his sound design. And so I was doing more sort of woody, sort of organic sounds as a counterpoint to that. It was a really nice way of working, a really clear sort of division of labor. And we would keep that discussion going. And there were plenty of occasions where, similar to how I was describing with Melanie, there would be passages of a sound score where it would be very difficult for either of us to unpick who had made what. But as with Gareth, I probably knew that if it was melodic or rhythmic, it was probably my responsibility. The final thing I want to say about those three examples is that I was never the custodian of QLab in any of those. Whereas with all the Clod Ensemble shows, I would always be the person that finally signed off on the sound design, even if I wasn't programming it all the time. And there have been examples, not with any of the three that I've told you about, but with other freelancers where, because they've been in control of QLab, there's been cues that I haven't been able to get through. There hasn't been enough time in tech, or the ambition that I have for them hasn't been able to be sort of given its full fruition. I say that's a big thing, that a collaboration with a sound designer, no matter how benign, you're always working to their timeline and knowing that there'll be things that they're having to sort out that may or may not chime with your own. But returning to my main point, despite all of the grey areas and maybe even sometimes awkwardness over defining these roles, I would rather have that kind of thing happen than get into a position where those roles are so formalized that there's no room for maneuver and that everyone knows what to expect. That's a reason for being involved in theater and not film. There's space to do the kind of things that I was describing in Red Ladies that would be almost impossible to propose to a film producer. So my hope is that we remain in that gray area for longer, keep discussing it, keep mixing it up, not work with the same people in the same way all the time. Thank you.
I'm Melanie Wilson. In 2022, I was invited as a sound practitioner and performance maker to be part of a collective on a project called You Heard Me. You Heard Me is a solo performance that uses sound, voice, and movement to examine the experience of sexual assault, trauma, and the power of voice. You Heard Me is a true story. At its heart is a single moment of noise, a scream that freed a woman from an attack. The woman is artist Luca Rutherford, and together with artists Maria Crocker, Tanuja Amarasuriya, Bethany Wells, Bethany Gupwell, Jenny Jackson, Stephanie McMahon, Lindsay Nanacorn, and myself, she set out to make a performance work that told the story of a violent sexual attack as a way to celebrate ideas around listening, the refusal to stay silent, and the power of voice and community. The making of this project invited each artist to collaborate through the channel of their own discipline, but to also participate in broader collective thinking around form, dramaturgy, ethics, and work practice. Each of us were able to define what that meant for ourselves, with the overall lens of the work focused on an intersectional feminist approach. As such, what I'm detailing for you here now shouldn't be taken to be definitively what happened, but instead what I heard, observed, and made sense of through my own practitioner lens. Our process began by sitting together as a group, listening to Luca, and making an audio recording of her account of the attack and her escape from it. We agreed that recording this account might form a basis for how to form an initial creative response to the subject matter. We undertook the recording as a collective, supporting Luca to safely recall the memory. The group asked questions occasionally to allow Luca to clarify or identify more detail. The act of recording Luca signified our intention to proceed from the starting point of Luca's voice. Luca's act of memory and our act of listening was an important step in holding her experience carefully, but also of allowing us all to step into the world of that experience and begin to form co-authorship of what that experience might sound and look and feel like for an audience. We used the recording and our own memories of what Luke had shared to identify the main moments of the timeline, including any key images, thoughts, actions, or sounds that Luca made. We then used that timeline to create a narrative architecture of the attack and escape, which ended up being composed of 10 sections. Our interest in charting the attack in this timeline was to create a chronological spine that could provide an initial form of structure to work along and away from. This mode of linear account referenced Luca's victim statement to the police, but it also laid the groundwork for one of the key disruptive mechanisms to emerge in the work, which was looping. Looping came to signify the effects of trauma on a person's chronology and memory. On reflection, there was also an urge to use the recording of Luca speaking about the attack as a way of drawing it away from her, in order that we might be able to use the recorded voice as a repository for language in the experience. The recorded voice, separated from the body in this way, became like a shield or a companion, allowing us to inhabit the space between body and mind, past and present, to tell the complex story of what happens there. The process of getting to this point as a collaborating group was hard won, and not as straightforward as I may have made it sound just now. As I think any attempt to make a creative, careful, resonant response to an experience of violence with solidarity can often be. The practical work of devising then began, but this moment of moving into the physical space of the timeline we had recorded and arranged to evoke it and to speak back to it was really quite vertiginous. How do we do this as both ethical practitioners and compassionate collaborators in a way that doesn't require Luca and her body to re-perform a timeline she was so subject to? We agreed to use sound and music to create a world to step into, a world that could speak a primary creative response to the chronology we had recorded. I've come to think of this decision as using sound as a safety net, an idea to deploy sound and music as vanguard, envoy, or broker, to send sound out first to meet the hard questions and open the discussion. Using sound and music as generative elements within a making process is very common to many practitioners. But in this project, the decided bringing into life of a speaking, singing, vibrating world that drew boundaries for us, that held us and opened shapes for us, had a much more significant identity to me. To indulge some further metaphors, forgive me, perhaps we thought of sound as shepherd, as spell, as armour or advocate. So I created a draft score composing variations on very simple percussive music material that evolved over 10 movements to mirror the stages in the storyboard timeline. The passage from one movement to the next wasn't set though, leaving us the flexibility to decide when to exit one section and enter the next. I wanted to work with rhythmic material that moved through variations and effects at different velocities to express this concept of narrative repetition and psychological looping that we had identified previously. But I also wanted to use the music as a sound space too, to use filters, speaker placement and sound design to create a physical spatial experience of the sound world for the audience. Added to this score were voice fragments of Luca's recorded account, processed and spatialized. From there, we worked with the sound score as a space to create a movement score for Luca to perform. The movement score was developed through relation to the storyboard moments, but inhabited its own logic and didn't necessarily align rhythmically or emotionally with the temperature or dynamic of each sound movement. In this way, we began to layer meaning and time frames, reaching towards a portrait of how trauma impacts memory and experience, but also how resilience and power grows. The collaborative effort then seemed to lie in each of us holding alive the possibility of many strands of perception at once through all the elements of sound, music, light, space, movement, and dramaturgy. We looped this 10-movement sequence 3 times, building repetition, variation, interpretation, and a narrative of growing strength. It was really important to us that amidst the elements of sound, music, voice, light, space, and movement, which were fierce and overwhelming at times, that we didn't lose sight of Luca as a figure of agency as well as vulnerability at the heart of the work. Again, we didn't want to unthinkingly create a situation where the female body was re-victimized by the mechanisms of theatrical representation, but was instead using them as tools to explore and examine the survivor experience with an audience. Each sequence loop then culminated in a very loud passage, coming at the end of a lengthy movement phrase that exhausted Luca. The cue for this loud passage was visibly communicated by Luca to the sound operator, thereby allowing her to consent to the most physically demanding sonic experience and to thereby collaborate with it and own its strength and fury as her own. Here then, in the space where the voice of the music meets the aesthetic of sound as architectural force, here is where we ultimately centred our ideological work as a collective. This symbiosis of sound music as manifestation of trauma, together with the energy of healing, held and released visibly with permission, completed the arc of the narrative we wanted to describe. This space also expressed our politics in using sound to speak violence in feminist performance practice. By working openly and collaboratively with sound and music as a primary touchstone for devising, by reframing the ways in which it spoke for us and in which we spoke and in which theatre making speaks with it, we were able to get close to honouring that originating moment of noise, a scream that freed a woman from an attack.
This conversation explores an intergenerational collaboration between two Melbourne-based queer artist researchers, director-dramaturg Alison Campbell, that's me, and composer-dramaturg Meta Cohen.
That's me.
We consider how our collaborative thinking about theatre through a focus on musicality and affect offers new ways of queering dramaturgies.
The discussion's based around the project that formed the genesis of our collaboration, a production of Dr. Faustus Lights the Lights by Gertrude Stein. What emerged was a synergy around the meeting of a queer director who thinks musically and a queer composer who thinks dramaturgically, and our exploration of new ways to articulate and map what's happening in the processes of making and rehearsal.
In seeking ways to articulate our various roles and collaborative modes, we are attracted to thinking around co-conspiracy and how this relates to queerness and our work on queer performance. Gender theorist Jack Halberstam writes,
"Queer subcultures in particular are often marked by a lack of distinction between the archivist and the cultural worker, and they may function as co-conspirators."
In short, in the spirit of Halberstam, we are queer intergenerational co-conspirators who are making interventions into queer performance, focusing particularly on affect and musicality.
And one specific way we're thinking about this is how we might queer dramaturgy through composition and orchestration. What makes dramaturgies queer, and what is queering dramaturgy, and why would we do it? To what end? What's it doing in the world? While we know that realist theatre has been important for LGBTQIA+ communities over time and through crises and the ongoing need for representation and visibility, we think that queer performance does its politics in a different way. It's less based in a character or plot-driven teleology that remains stuck to ideas of consistency of character. Queerness wants to resist fixity.
Which brings us inevitably to form, which is perhaps the crux of our co-conspiracy, our attempts towards specificity in how we think about form and how it works. To a surprising degree, we are queer formalists. And I suppose for me, the part of the excitement of our co-conspiracy is the specificity of language you bring through your specialist knowledge of musicality, what Robin Nelson would call your know-how, and then your work looking at how that's queering or how you can think about queering through musicality.
Well, as with any lens, though, it can only be delivered with collaborators who want to share that language. And I think the reason we find so much resonance is through your thinking around affect and the way the elements are arranged. And then, of course, the interest in bringing those aesthetic considerations towards queer dramaturgies.
I do know that for a long time people have written about my directing as a type of choreography or something that lends itself to thinking of it as something other than, for instance, psychology-led types of realist directing.
There's also that thing your former colleague Paul Monahan said about your directing, that it's a dramaturgy of punctuation. That's musical. It's actually the first thing that really struck me when I started working with you, is that you're not necessarily using musicological language, but it's a musical understanding. For example, the way that you organise bodies in space looks to me like layers of melody or harmony, or like instruments. It's orchestration.
And that's probably a good moment for us to turn to our example of Stein's Dr. Faustus Lights the Lights, our first collaboration. And I was the director and you were a dramaturg and composer.
Yeah, and we found the openness of that text, an invitation to explore affect, musicality, queerness, to take the base materials and arrange them in a particular way or to compose them.
And you've been talking recently about doing dramaturgy like a composer and composing like a dramaturg, which I really love. In Dr. Faustus, the musicality is so crucial in terms of thinking about the way performance works as an experience and not just this meaning-making machine to transfer ideas. We can feel something and we know it differently. And I think that's what I loved about the text. And then what you were bringing in terms of your dramaturgical thinking via composition, the patterns you were finding and the different documents you were making to identify and track those patterns was so helpful. And in many cases, the first time anyone had given me materials like that, for example, your pitch extractions.
Yeah, I really made those to understand how the text was working. So I assigned specific pitches to certain repeated syllables to illustrate the word music that Stein was making, which helped me understand how that repetitive language, which at first glance really seems like quite a wash of words, can build to sonic climaxes and has quite a musical structure, which is about patterns, repetitions and accumulations, familiar terrain for a composer.
Dr. Faustus, are you there? The dog murmurs, thank you, thank you. And the boy says, there is somebody, of course, there is somebody just there. There is somebody, somebody's there, oh yes, somebody's there.
I'm still wondering for each of us how we were at that time reading the text of Dr. Faustus as queer, or maybe more precisely full of queering potential. We've talked about Stein's work being queer avant la lettre in terms of how we're co-opting that word, but if we think back to our queer formalism, what is it exactly that jumped out at each of us?
An example of how that queering potential plays out in performance choices that we co-conspire to make, if you like, is our approach to the figure of Marguerite Ida and Helena Annabelle, who we called Miha, as a woman with four names and who draws attention to binary notions of gender, identity, heteronormativity.
Yeah, the excess of those four names certainly feels queer. And formally, the text demands an exploration of ambiguity and resistance to fixity that we understood as full of queering potential at the time. The fluidity is evident both in the characters' fractured identities and the text's temporal uncertainty. We go forwards and backwards with no normative temporal logic, and tenses change sentence to sentence. With Stein, it's a cubism, isn't it? Many angles and planes. So with our acronym MIHA, our performance choices don't create a gay figurehead, but it is a queering in its refusal to sit in a single version of her. This might be seen also in the set design, in which we had multiple curtains which revealed more and more of the depth of the stage as the performance went on, and there was something about hiding things and revealing them in general, and specifically something about the revelation of Miha.
You know, I think that hiding revelation has got something to do with mythologizing, actually, because you've got the anticipation around this hybrid woman person long before she appears on stage. She's talked about, and there's certainly a sense of celebrity or hype. In the sound design and my role as composer, I chose to emphasise Stein's repetitive language and oral motifs. So I built on musical offers from the actors to create a leitmotif, a musical theme for Miha, which appears in the sound design and references to her from very early on.
Ida,
Stein's language as variations on a theme, perhaps we might understand Marguerite Eider and Helena Annabelle as variations on the theme of woman. I think a lot of decisions we made around Miha were in dialogue with those normative, non-normative, and archetypal femininities. There's a punk moment, for example, where we co-opted the musical and scenographic conventions of a mosh pit, and there was a strong, effective build, and then Miha was a punk singer performing a Riot Girl-style song built around that leitmotif. But I'm also thinking of her early song, De Viper's Sting. Throughout the play, we talked about using varying musical genres as a way of engaging with the temporal uncertainty of the play. Like Miha's resistance towards fixity and binary, that song is in between genres, beginning with jazz influences that really place it within those quite conventional expectations of the, you know, sultry yet satirical song performed by a single, usually female performer in cabaret, burlesque, or musical theatre settings. But then the beats and time signatures constantly shift in the second half, which prevents it kind of from becoming fixed and the tonality changes. Along with your Busby Berkeley-esque movement sequence, this allowed it to flip between playfulness, sexuality, and a dialogue with the real and metaphorical threat of the viper bite, and perhaps also a deeper existential preoccupation with womanness. She asks, am I Marguerite Eider or am I Helena Annabelle? Of course, cabaret modes also have a history rooted in queer performance.
So over this long period I've been working as a director, I've been interested in texts where the language is doing very particular things and trying to find the language for the performance of that. Anne Bogart's viewpoints and Eugenio Barba's organic dramaturgy have been really useful and helpful in that way. But really, for me to suddenly work with someone who brought your composer brain and language and the specificity with all of that in terms of musicality and the relationship with affect has shifted my understanding of what's possible. Well, maybe I always knew what was possible, but what changed was the capacity to realise it. And for me, working with you means that when we encounter a text and you produce your graphic scoring and other ways of demonstrating your understanding of rhythm and affective patterning, patterning of all sorts, but particularly around affect, that's really exciting for me.
It is exciting. We talk about scores a lot. You create scores with and for performers and also with scenographic elements. I do a lot of dramaturgical scoring too, notated graphic scoring as well. And I think that's really where we meet, isn't it? Because it's this intimate dramaturgical understanding of theatre as scored. And of course, this is drawn from ideas of Anne Bogart, as well as George Home Cook, and of course, Matthias Rebstock and David Rösner.
I think we both do it separately or have done it separately in different ways. But now that when we work together, it really matches up, doesn't it? Because we both understand ourselves as contributing to that score or forming it. So co-composing or clearly co-conspiring.
I knew it. The electric lights, they told me so. No dog can know, no boy can know. I cannot know, they cannot know. The electric lights, they told me so.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode. Stay tuned for part 3 of the audio papers. This next episode will include 2 slightly more academic papers, which are by Polish academic and researcher Maciej Gudzi and British Cypriotic scholar Dimitris Savros. Stay tuned and thank you and goodbye.